Good morning, everybody. Hi. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. You can check us out on Twitter, at Nick D Show. But the best way to stay connected and to be a part of the show is to like us on Facebook, facebook.com/Nick D Show. Everything that's happening on the show is happening on our Facebook page as it happens. So facebook.com/Nick D Show. Monday morning, and that means many things, including my dad calls in a little bit later to tell a joke because it's a jokey time. But it also means it's time to review the movies. The Monday morning movie reviews with Eric Childress and Colin Suter happen every Monday morning. We review the new movies, and then Eric and I stick around and talk about the box office for the week. And this week is no different. Let's welcome to the show. Here's Eric Childress. Hello, Eric.
Hello.
And Colin Suter. Hello, Colin.
Hello there.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
All righty, then. Let's get right to it, because we got a few here we want to talk about, a couple of which are pretty great. So we want to get to those. Let us say that I am surprised that none of us saw Trumbo. I'm surprised by that. I didn't get a chance to see it over the weekend, but I thought one of you guys would have seen it.
It was on my to-do list, but the to-do list got altered quite a bit this weekend. So
this is the film in which Bryan Cranston plays Dalton Trumbo, incredibly popular screenwriter who was part of the blacklisting and McCarthy hearings in the 50s. And Bryan Cranston plays him. I hear mixed things about it. Jay Roach directed it. Jay Roach started out doing, the stupid Austin Powers movies. And then he did the Meet the Parents movies. Or at least, I don't know if he did all of them, but I know he did the first.
He did the first two.
Oh, he did the first two. Okay.
Yeah.
But then somehow he got this reputation now of being sort of a political director, having directed two pretty decent HBO political movies, which was what was the first one? The vote
recount,
which was terrific.
Mm-hmm.
And Game Change, which was also terrific.
Yep.
And so maybe that, maybe because this also it deals with Hollywood stuff, but it also deals with politics. And so, who knows?
Right.
So, but anyway, that is out right now, and we'll talk how it did at the box office a little bit later on. But that is of interest, and there's a chance that some of the things associated with that and performances associated with that will be considered for Oscars or at least award ceremony stuff at the end of the year. So keep that one in mind. All right, well, let's get to some of the other ones that we have to do here. All right, Eric, why don't you handle and tell us about My All American, which is a film I did not see.
Okay, well, this is a true story of, I forget the guy's name, but a football player, a college football player who is really, lives up to the title of the movie. He is literally like Johnny Optimist. He is a hard worker. He, the minute he could, get on the football field and carry a football and make his father and parents proud of him, he could. And he ends up in college and becomes basically sort of the toast of the team. He's a defensive player mostly, but his winning attitude and, never die spirit really just becomes infectious for the team. And they have a tremendous winning streak. The coach is played by Aaron Eckhart. The young man is played by Finn Wittrock, who's on American Horror Story, I guess. And so that's that's sort of the general gist of the movie until tragedy strikes. And the movie basically sort of wants to turn into sort of a more modern day Newt Rockne type story. And that's kind of what this movie feels like, right down to sort of every cheesy, just sort of detail where the movie sort of forgets to really sort of bring any kind of genuine drama to it. This film was written from the writer of Hoosiers and Rudy, which are two underdog stories were directed by the same guy, David Anspaugh.
Yeah.
And but this one was not directed by him. It was directed by Angelo Pizzo, who you know, was the writer of those two movies. And clearly he's much more of a writer than a director. He doesn't really have sort of the necessary skills on how to sort of craft a serious dramatic story. It seems like this might be something, you know, for like the faith-based crowd in a little bit. I mean, there is mentions of this character, you know, going to church and stuff like that, but it's really not that kind of movie. It's just sort of a really overly earnest drama that, you know, for the better part of the movie, doesn't really have any drama in it. It's just he's kind of a perfect human being in a way. He's got, you know, the best girls, played by Sarah Bolger. You know, he's got, you know, parents who, you know, support him, even though you don't see much of them except, you know, rooting him on. His coach loves him. His teammates love him. Everybody loves him. And then, you know, a bad thing happens to him. But that's like almost in the last third of the story. It's like for the first hour of the movie, everything's great. Then he starts to get a little pain in his leg, and it starts to get worse and worse and worse. And then finally gets diagnosed like a half hour before the movie ends, and then the movie ends. So, you know, I'm sure people who knew the real guy would find interest in the story, and I'm glad that there's such a wonderful human being that did exist on the planet at one point, but doesn't exactly make for great cinema.
Mm. You know, why did it take so long for this guy to do another movie? Well, I mean, he's never directed a movie before, but
yeah.
I mean, Rudy was like 20 years ago.
He did some wrote or direct. I don't know if he directed the other movie. He wrote some other sports movie. I think it was a baseball movie. I think
okay.
That kind of came and went. No one really heard about it.
Okay,
but yeah, but you're right. Rudy was 1993.
Wow, it's 22 years ago.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. I enjoyed Hoosiers. I'm not crazy about Rudy. But Hoosiers, man, I love that movie.
Great movie.
Yeah. Okay. All right. And it's got a good cast. I mean, you know, Aaron Eckhart's good.
Yeah. And I should mention that if we do end up with one of our categories at the end of the year for worst old age makeup.
Oh, no.
Yeah. The movie begins with Aaron Eckhart in the old age makeup, recounting the story of, you know, this guy that, you know, who would you classify as, you know, you're all American? Well, I'd classify this guy.
Yeah.
And he's in the old age makeup, and okay. It bookends the story, and it's just, it's cringeworthy.
All right. Well, it opened up in a bunch of theaters, despite the fact that I never even heard of it until Friday. So I don't know. But it didn't work. We'll talk about how well or bad. Well, it didn't do well.
No.
So we'll talk about that a little bit later on, but that's my All-American. All right, Colin, let's talk about What Our Fathers Did, A Nazi Legacy.
And now for something completely different.
Yes.
All right, this is a documentary about a human rights lawyer named Nicholas Frank, who has an interest in Nazi war crimes and those who carry them out, and he meets two German men whose fathers were instrumental in helping Hitler carry out, you know, mass genocide against the Jews. One of these guys named Philippe knows that his father did horrible things, but has sort of rose-tinted memories of him at home being a good dad, so it's hard for him to reconcile what a monster he really was. And the other guy has no problems condemning his father and knows, you know, darn well that he was a monster unworthy of forgiveness in any respect. And the movie becomes about how these two guys grew up under similar circumstances, but how they both differ in their approach to dealing with their fathers being guilty of heinous war crimes. You know, for which they were executed. And the movie is just, and so the lawyer sort of becomes this, you know, this go-between, this moderator between these two as they go through, you know, Holocaust museums and going to mass graves and really confronting their realities and how, you know, one guy is just so reluctant to say, yeah, you know, my father was, a monster. And the other guy's just like, what is wrong with you? How can you not see what our fathers did? How can you just be so passive about this? And it just becomes this fascinating, back and forth between these two guys.
Is one guy just in denial?
Yeah. Oh, serious denial. And just, and probably still is to this day. And it just becomes about, how we, just some people just view their parents just based on, how they were treated at home, and never mind what they did for a living, or whatever mind what they did when they, walked out the door every day. And the other guy's father, was a monster no matter what, no matter where he was or who he was. So it's a lot easier for him, but it is about that denial. Mm. And it's a really strong film about, in a way, sort of, like a distant cousin for The Art of Killing,
going
back and revisiting, these things. Not nearly on the same level, artistically, but it's a really compelling documentary, and it's playing at the Siskel Center right now.
Okay. What Our Fathers Did, A Nazi Legacy, at the Siskel Center right now. It sounds pretty fascinating, actually. Jeez.
Yeah, it's you get really caught up in it. And, like I said, the back and forth between these two guys, with the lawyer being the moderator, is a really – it's a great format for the documentary, as they walk through these places and deal with this stuff.
All right. Okay, well, thank you, Colin. Everybody hang on. Eric and Colin are here, and we've got more movies to review, and then Eric and I will tell you all about the winners and losers this weekend at the box office. More of this is coming up, as we do every Monday morning, with the movie reviews. Nick DiGiulio on 720 WGN. Good morning, everybody. Welcome back. And the movie reviews continue on this Monday morning, as we do every Monday morning. It's the Monday Morning Movie Reviews. And our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. You can check us out on Twitter at Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page. So like us at facebook.com/Nick D Show. Eric Childress, Colin Suter from eFilmCritic.com, RogerEbert.com join me every Monday to review the new movies. And we are reviewing the new films. And let's get back to that. And Eric and I will actually be talking about the box office in just a little bit. Welcome back, gentlemen.
Hello.
So am I to understand that neither of you saw The 33?
Correct.
Okay, well, I'll give it a go. The 33 is this new drama which tells the story of, we all know what the story is. In 2010, 33 Chilean miners were in a collapse. The gold and copper mine collapsed, and they were stuck underground for 69 days. And I think everybody pretty much remembers following this story on social media. Not so much now, or not so much then, as we follow everything on social media now. And I think this weekend proves that, and for good and bad, quite frankly. We can talk about that another time. But we were watching it, the live coverage on television, and it was, like one of the top news stories for all 69 days that these guys were trapped down there. And this movie tells that story and brings it to life in very straightforward, very dramatic fashion. And it tells what happens, it gives you some background on some of the miners. You get to know very well, particularly two, Antonio Banderas and Lou Diamond Phillips. You really get to know those guys are the standouts and sort of the main characters that you follow through everything that happens. You follow everything that's happening above ground as well, politically, what's happening, the rescue effort, and what is happening with the families of the guys that are trapped in this mine. It's pretty straightforward. There's nothing really spectacular about it. It kind of plays like a TV movie. In that regard, I was kind of disappointed because they went the straight route. You know what I'm talking about? The very sort of predictable, this is the kind of movie that anybody could make about this situation.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I'm not trying to discount what happened in real life, because this is an incredible story, and the fact that these guys got out, and I'm not ruining them. I mean, if you followed the news, you know that these guys got out. But it does it in a way. I just wish they could have done it a little more creatively, told the story a little bit more originality and a little bit less cliche. But having said that, it's a pretty harrowing movie. It is a movie about survival. And there's been a few of those this year. That seems to be a theme this year. Have you guys noticed that? That there's been some movies that are just about like, okay, we got to survive this. Everest is the first one that comes to mind, which I'm just, and this is another one of these movies where it's just like, how are these guys going to eat? How are they going to survive? How are they going to, you know, not suffocate? How are they going to survive the stress between everyone there? And so on and so forth. And, you know, like I said, it's nothing special. It does play like a TV movie, but an incredibly, interestingly cast TV movie in that regard. I mean, some really, you know, it's like, I believe they've covered, I don't know, maybe 60% of all nationalities in terms of actors are covered in this film, playing different ethnicities of their own. It's really interesting.
Gabriel Byrne.
Gabriel Byrne is in it. Juliette Binoche is in it. Brolin is in it. It's interesting.
Brolin Senior, right?
Yeah. James Brolin. Mr. Streisand is in it.
Right, exactly.
Oscar Nunez is in it, and it's just so the casting is kind of all over the map and kind of interesting, and I think everybody does a pretty good job. In it. I was never bored by it. There are moments in the movie that are harrowing. It was an incredibly, an incredible test of faith, strength, endurance, mental capacity that these guys had to go through. And that's shown in the movie, although I don't think as creatively as it could have been. But I do want to mention a couple of the performances. I think Antonio Banderas, I've always been a fan of Antonio Banderas's, and he hasn't. What was the last like? I mean, obviously he's Puss in Boots. You know, like that was
right.
Like sort of the last big sort of thing that he did.
Expendables was the last thing.
And he was great in that. Yeah, he was terrific.
Yeah.
In that. Yeah. But I really like Antonio Banderas, and he's terrific in this movie. But I gotta say, the dude that comes out of the woodwork, where I was like, where has this guy been, and why isn't he working more, and why is he doing stupid I'm a bad cook reality shows, is Lou Diamond Phillips, who's great in this movie. Like, it's a really terrific performance, to the point where it was like, is he doing made-for-sci-fi network movies now? Is that what's going on? I mean, because there was a time when Lou Diamond Phillips, obviously after La Bamba came out,
Yeah,
he was the flavor of the month, and he had done some movies in that time that I really liked him. He's Stand and Deliver. He's terrific in Stand and Deliver.
Mm-hmm.
Renegades. The First Power.
Oh, I thought we were just naming Lou Diamond Phillips.
No. And I just started because I went right to The First Power.
Nice.
But no, I actually like this guy. I liked him when he first came out. I always would look forward. I would hope he'd do well. You know. And for a while there, he was on a hot streak. I mean, he became part of a hunky franchise that could have gone, you know, like he was
he's in both Young Guns
he's
movies.
In both Young Guns movies, man. And so, but he's really great in this movie, and the stuff between him and Banderas is terrific. And I think adds a much needed weight to a relatively, a TV-like movie. So good for Lended, I guess, if you're interested in it. I could go either way on it. 2.5 stars is what I'm looking at here. So I'm sorry to be wishy-washy, but there you go. okay, so let's see. Where are we going? Where are we going to go next here? Oh, you know what? Eric, you didn't see it, and I didn't see it. But Colin, you actually did go out and see Love the Coopers.
Yeah, speaking of endurance.
I apologize, my friend. So go ahead. Tell us.
All right. Well, this is one of those, Love the Coopers. This is one of those ensemble pieces with multiple storylines going on. But they're all tied together through one big family. Everyone is on their way to the main parental household for Christmas. Diane Keaton and John Goodman play the parents. Marissa, try to stay with me here. Marissa Tomei plays Diane Keaton's sister.
Right.
Single sister who meets a cop, played by Anthony Mackie, after she gets caught shoplifting. Alan Arkin plays Diane Keaton's dad. Do the math. A single guy who has a crush on a waitress, played by Amanda Seyfried. Yeah, well, it's sort of like, you know, he goes to the diner every week and they're friends.
Oh, all right.
He loans her movies. It's not creepy.
Okay. I was going to say, oh, man.
Yeah, no, it's not. Yeah. No, it's perfectly innocent.
Okay.
But, Ed Helms and Olivia Wilde play the Diane Keaton and John Goodman's offspring. Helms is in the middle of a divorce and has two kids. And Olivia Wilde meets a Marine at the airport, whom she brings home to meet her parents, and they pretend to be engaged. And I think that's everyone. Oh, and June Squibb plays Goodman's mom, and she says crazy things because that's what you do with June Squibb now.
Doesn't that just suck?
Yeah. So, so like I said, there's a lot of math you have to do that doesn't quite add up. The casting of Diane Keaton in the central role is probably the biggest problem, in that Diane Keaton is 69 years old.
Right.
Marissa Tomei, late 40s, I think. So that's a problem. They're just trying to make Diane Keaton look younger, but it's just like, why not just get a younger actress? And then there's a moment in the film where, her and John Goodman tell somebody like, oh yeah, we were hippies back in the day. And they cut to a flashback of them in, total 60s hippie garb, frolicking in the woods. And then later on in the movie, while they're arguing, Diane Keaton, I think, says something along the lines of, we should have taken that trip to Africa 30 years ago. And she says, well, we were only 20 then. And you're like, well, wait a minute. Hold on. What were you hippies in the 60s? Were you in the 80s? I bring this up because this is a symptom of a bigger thing in this film, is that you spend a lot of time doing the math that doesn't add up. It's lazy screenwriting. There's a lot of lazy screenwriting going on here. It's like it's this guy's first script, and nobody did a rewrite on it. Nobody did a polish. And it's a lot of scenes where everything is completely forced. There's no natural progression to an argument in this movie. It's everything starts out pleasant, and then one character decides, no, wait, we're going to argue now. We're going to say unpleasant things to each other. We're going to have these big revelations. And it's just so forced and manipulative and trite. Steve Martin narrates it. I forgot to mention that. Steve Martin is the narrator, and it is one of the most cloying Hallmark card narrations you've ever seen or ever heard, I should say. And then the big reveal as to who's actually narrating will make you pull your hair out. It's really annoying. The best word I can use for this film is annoying. Everybody in it is annoying. Even actors that I like are annoying in it. It's a movie that thinks it's being really deep and profound when actually it's just full of, fortune cookie Hallmark card isms. It shoves Christmas down your throat more than Love Actually did, and does so in a way that is, the opposite of what Love Actually did. Cause I'm a huge fan of that movie. But this is just one of the most annoying films I've seen all year, and you should not love the Coopers at all.
Okay.
So
this is, by the way, from the director of I Am Sam and Karina Karina.
There you go.
Yeah.
There's a resume.
Yeah, that is a hell of a resume right there. All right.
A lot of reaction shots of the dog in this film. So yeah.
Well, when done correctly, a la The Burbs. it can be a magnificent moment in film history.
It can be. You know it's desperate when it does that. And there's another and the big reveal why they do that is also annoying, too. So.
Wow. All right.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. All right. I'm sorry. Now I'm just thinking about that shot in The Burbs where I just almost – I fall off the couch every time they cut to the dog. Every time you see Tom Hanks and Rick Dukeman making their way towards the house.
Close up of the eyes. Yeah, everybody's eyes.
Including the dog.
The poodle. Yep.
Hilarious. Oh, my God, that movie rules. Okay, now where would you rank this? We're about to break here, Colin, but where would you rank this in the Fred Clauses and the Four Christmases and all the other crap that comes out right around this time of year that kind of covers the same crap category?
Yeah, you know, I never saw Fred Claus. Four Christmases might be a little worse in that because there's a lot more broad physical humor, like everybody, you know, attacking each other physically and
Sure. Knocking
over Christmas trees. And not a lot of that in this film, but there may as well be, you know, given the tone and everybody's behavior.
Okay.
I will say this, the movie has a decent soundtrack. There's some Bob Dylan songs that shouldn't be in there but are in there that are nice to listen to. And there's a good song by the Fleet Foxes at the beginning of the movie that went through my head all week, which is a great song that I like. But you know, that's, you know, save your money, everybody,
okay.
Please.
All right, so love the Coopers, not good. All right, guys, Yeah. Hang on. Eric and Colin are with me, and we've got more movies to review. We've got more box office to tell you about. Eric and I will give you that as well. More coming up right here. It's the Monday Morning Movie Reviews, and it's Nick DiGilio on 720 WGN. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Monday Morning Movie Reviews happen every Monday morning right here on WGN. And they continue right now. Our phone number is 312-981-7200. Check us out at facebook.com/NickDShow. Before we get back to the new ones, Eric, have you seen Leisure Class yet?
Not yet. I am I have three episodes to go on Project Greenlight. I'm anxious to finish it because it's a ridiculously addictive show.
Yeah.
I gotta say, I ordered HBO Now, and I watched the whole Project Greenlight and the first half hour of Leisure Class. So.
All right, Colin, where do you stand then?
Well, I don't know where I stand quite on the film yet because I'm not done with it yet. But I think as far as, and I only saw the first Project Greenlight. I never saw any of the other ones.
Okay.
It is addictive, definitely. I got through the whole thing this weekend, and I don't know. I'm not quite as down on the director as you guys are. I definitely think he makes a lot of mistakes and a lot of stupid decisions. But at the same time, I kind of get where that comes from. You know, when you're handed this sort of golden ticket to do your own thing, and you're in your, I'm guessing the guy's in his mid-20s or something.
Yeah, he's got to be in his mid-20s, yeah.
Yeah, and just full of that naivete and confidence at the same time, which I think is, you know, typical of, you know, anybody at that age, no matter what your profession is. You want to take risks, you want to take chances, you want to, you know, do that sort of thing. And I think the guy is, watching him on the set, he is kind of a natural director in terms of, you know, having that confidence. Whereas I thought Pete Jones was, you know, kind of a little too, not quite as
green,
decisive, not quite as, yeah. I don't know. But, I mean, there are times when it's just like, oh, dude, you got to get over this. You know, get over yourself and really look at the bigger picture here. I imagine it's not always easy on your first film and on your first set. But I actually kind of found the line producer a little more annoying.
Effie?
In terms of some of the drama she's causing unnecessarily.
Okay.
That drove me batty more so. Than he did. So,
oh,
okay. Yeah, I'm with Colin on that part. I mean, as far as I'm only up to the point where they're still trying to get signatures from the houses,
yeah.
Which I don't, you know, that person should be fired for because I don't know how hard it is to get signatures, and I don't know why anyone's not asking the right questions. I'm like, are these people not home? Why can't you get 23 signatures?
Wondering.
Say we're filming a movie in your neighborhood.
Yeah,
you know, I don't get that part. But no, as far as what his behavior on the set, I haven't seen anything that would make me hate him on the set. I think he was stubborn and a little self-righteous and a little too proud of himself right after winning. But, like Effie and her drama with Pete Farrelly, I thought was completely uncalled for. And frankly, and Dear White People kind of sucks anyway. I'm not pro anybody, but I'm more anti Effie at the moment.
Wow. That's not at all how I feel. All right. Well, we really quickly, because we got to break again, Colin, and we'll come back. But what do you think of the first half hour of Leisure Class?
I've seen worse. it's not great so far, but because I invested all my time in the documentary,
yeah.
I'm more interested in the film.
Yeah.
I can see where there are real inconsistencies with the lighting and everything. You can see that in the editing. Like there's some really like choppy edits and inconsistencies, like where what time of day it is,
sure.
In some shots. And, I just think Project Greenlight itself, the whole way it's done is what is the problem that leads to these mediocre movies being made.
Oh,
it's
I agree.
Not so much the director.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with that assessment completely. And I think we can all agree with that. Okay. We got a break here for the news. Eric, Colin, hang out. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Yep. There is Eric and Colin, and they will be back to review the rest of the new movies. And Eric and I will stick around and tell you about the box office. Morning, everyone. We are live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower. It's Nick DiGilio here to your overnight dude, 2 to 5 a.m. every weekday morning. And on Mondays, I get to hang out for the first hour of the Steve Cochran Show with the gang. And we'll do that this morning. Monday morning also means my dad will call in and he will tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And also we have a very exciting Blackhawks Express to play. Good weekend for the Hawks. Way to kick off a couple of wins before that circus trip. So we got the highlights from last night's game against Calgary coming up. But right now we're in the middle of the movie reviews, Monday morning movie reviews with Eric Childress and Colin Suter. From efilmcritic.com and RogerEbert.com, and we've got more movies to review, and we welcome the guys back. Welcome back, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Eric, please tell us about By the Sea.
Okay. This is the third film directed by Angelina Jolie, or the first film directed by Angelina Jolie Pitt, mm-hmm. as she is credited in the film. And it stars her and her husband, Brad, as a married couple who go to some part of France by the sea to work on their marital issues. The film is set sometime in the mid-70s, which we know basically because someone's holding up a magazine that says something about Pat Nixon fashion tips or something. Basically you have Brad Pitt, who's a writer, a one-time successful writer, and Jolie is his wife, who basically just sort of is quiet and spends all her time in bed while he goes out and tries to write and basically drinks all day. So she's in bed all day. He drinks all day. Occasionally they say something to each other. Then a honeymooning couple moves in next door. One of them played by Brad's Inglourious Basterds co-star Melanie Laurent. And she begins sort of peeping on them through a hole in their adjoining rooms, and basically just peeping on them, having sex and being nude and basically being honeymooners. And soon her husband discovers that she's doing this, and he decides to join in. And this sort of sparks a little something in them. And so all of a sudden they're having a few more smiles and a few more conversations, and they go out in the town and things like that. But there's kind of a grander plan in mind, at least we would hope, and we sort of get to the revelation of exactly why they're having so many problems. A revelation that you could probably guess within 5 minutes of the film. The rest of the movie is basically, like I said, it's Jolie's basically in bed most of the time. Brad Pitt drinks and gets drunk and sits in front of a typewriter. We don't really get a sense of who these people may have been at one time, even happily. They've apparently been married for like 14 years, and we don't understand how either of them could stand each other for even one of those years. The idea of them sort of spying on the couple is sort of an interesting place to go, except it's sort of introduced too late, and what it's ultimately leading up to is, would have been a more fascinating starting point in sort of a Hitchcockian De Palma type of way, but Jolie sort of misses the boat on that. And so you basically have sort of a very long, very, 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 very long setup for what seems to be a prequel for Raising Arizona. Yeah, and I mean, I'm not even joking when I say that. Yeah, like I said, you can sort of guess what the revelation is, you know.
You know, I mean, I had that in my head when I saw the trailer for this movie. I saw the trailer, and I'm like, well, I probably can figure out what's wrong with these two.
Right.
And it's
right.
And not to give
the line.
Oh, she does.
She actually is crying and says the line.
It's interesting that she wrote it too, right?
Yes.
Okay. It's interesting that someone who has 63 kids would actually, you know, I mean, maybe that's some sort of exercise that she wanted to do, or maybe it was some sort of way for her to maybe express how wonderful it is to have a family.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. What the hell do I know? I haven't seen the movie, so I don't know.
Yeah, I take it actually a step further. I think this is actually her sort of admittance that she's a homewrecker.
Ah. Oh.
And, you know, again, when it takes, you know, an hour and 45 minutes to sort of get to that point. And if you would have, you know, maybe started there, you might have, you know, sort of, you know, come up with, a pseudo marital thriller in a way. But she doesn't. So it's like I said, there's not much to this movie. There's not much to these characters. You know, they cry, they get drunk, they yell at each other. There's a lot of nudity. But it's a painstakingly staking bore sitting through time with these characters. Mm-hmm. It's like sitting in a, you know, going out to dinner with a couple that just clearly hates each other and just makes you completely uncomfortable to be around them.
Yeah, yeah.
And you just want to leave. You don't want to spend any time with these people. So I don't know why anyone would want to watch a movie like this. It looks pretty. Okay. Now, like you said, there's lots of nudity, but so what?
Okay. All right. Okay. That's kind of what I thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I don't know. Okay. By the Sea. You know, I read one review, or at least like the last part of a review, that actually said, yeah, people are going to think about this in the same way that people thought about Geely and Shanghai Surprise in terms of like real-life couples making movies together.
Yeah, Swept Away.
And
Swept Away, another good one.
Yeah, Swept Away. Mm-hmm. All right.
Yeah, it's more, okay, so I'm trying to think if this is worse than any of those.
Yeah,
I don't know. I'd rather watch Geely again.
Yeah, there's stuff in Geely. You know, Geely's a bad movie, but it's not as bad as its reputation.
It's the best of those movies that we just mentioned.
No, it's no question. Well, that's not saying much.
We're doing a list.
No, I understand. I understand. But, I mean, the thing about Geely is, yes, it's a bad film.
Mm-hmm.
But there are things in Geely that I enjoyed.
And there's a fascinating backstory to it as well.
Absolutely. Just,
you know, how it was messed with and what it was a completely different movie at one point.
And directed by a really talented director. That's the other thing about that movie is that, like, a lot of these, you know, like, Shanghai Surprise. Who the hell directed Shanghai Surprise? Oh, James Foley directed it. Oh, man. Okay, so that's another
good... James Foley directed Shanghai Surprise?
Didn't he?
Did Who's That Girl?
Oh, he did Who's That Girl?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know who directed Shanghai. Oh, I know he did a really terrible Madonna movie. I didn't know.
Yeah, he did Who's That Girl.
Oh, man. Okay.
After At Close Range.
Right, after as a favor. It's like, all right, I'll do it. Who Jim Goddard directed who directed Shanghai Surprise.
No relation to Drew, I hope.
I don't know. I don't think so. All right. Now, Eric, am I to understand this?
Uh-huh.
You didn't see Brooklyn?
No.
Oh, man. All right.
I missed it at Sundance. I have to go back. This is one of those experiments where I have to go back and look at my schedule and see what I missed it for.
Okay.
because like it was one of those things. Well, yeah, I had, couldn't fit into my schedule for some reason, or I chose to see something else, and everyone, you know, then starts raving about it. I'm like, you know, damn it. And I just haven't had a chance to see it.
Okay.
I could have seen it before Toronto if someone would have invited me to that screening, but no, they invited like one person.
Oh.
So I didn't get to see it, and I didn't get to see it in Toronto, so
all right.
Crap.
Okay, well, Colin, why don't you first explain what Brooklyn is all about? Give us the synopsis,
right,
and then we'll come back, okay? You give us the synopsis, we'll take a break, we'll come back, you and I will review it for Eric and everyone else.
All right.
All right.
It's our, how do you pronounce her name?
Circe Ronan.
Circe Ronan. As an Irish woman named Eilis, who lives in Ireland and who's about to migrate to New York, specifically to Brooklyn, to start a new life where she can have more opportunities. And she gets a room in a boarding house with other immigrants. She lands a job in a high-end clothing store. And she meets an Italian plumber played by Emory Cohen, who I don't recall seeing in anything before.
I didn't recognize him. Yeah.
Okay. And he eventually, you know, wins her heart, and her new life is going smoothly, but she still misses her homeland and her family. And a tragedy in her family forces her to return to Ireland, and she sees an opportunity to start over again there, and kind of has to make a choice between these two lives that she could potentially lead. Julie Christie and James Broadbent are also in the film. You want to stop there?
Yeah,
that's basically the gist of the
That's
film.
Good. That's the gist of it. And by the way, we do want to mention that it's adapted from a novel, and the guy who adapted it is Nick Hornby, who has written some great stuff, including High Fidelity, the book. Okay. Colin, Eric, hang on. And we will come back, and Colin and I will review Brooklyn, and then we'll finish up the movie reviews and talk about box office. That's all coming up right here on 720 WGN. Monday morning movie reviews continue, everyone. Hi. Nick DiGiulio here. We are live on Chicago's very own 720 WGN here till 5 a.m., and then we'll hang out with Cochran and the gang after 5. All right. Eric Childress, Colin Suter, welcome back.
Thank you.
Colin,
yes.
You just told us the plot of this new film called Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And what did you think of the film?
I think it's magnificent. I think it's a great movie about the immigrant experience, and probably one that a lot of, you know, immigrants can relate to. And I think, you know, the central one of the things that makes it truly great is Saoirse Ronan, who, you know, I haven't really delved into this too much, but, you know, she might be near the top, or she is near the top, if not the top, of my best actress ballot. I think it's just such a wonderful, centered performance that, you know, it just really filled me with hope for her. And I think the movie's simplicity is really one of its strengths. I mean, it's a very simple film, but it's, you know, sort of effortless, which is, that'll be a word I'll be using again tonight. But and I think having Nick Hornby adapt it, you know, Hornby's becoming a very interesting screenwriter. I mean, he's, you know, known for all this sort of these stories about, you know, arrested adolescence and males, you know, with, you know, High Fidelity and About a Boy and Fever Pitch and all that, you know. But then to start your screenwriting career with something like An Education and then this, it shows like just how versatile this guy is, and how what's interesting is that I can still hear his voice in this film, you know, about a 1950s immigrant in New York. You know, you can still hear Hornby's voice in some of the dialogue. There's moments of, you know, there's moments of great humor in the film. I was laughing a lot. All the stuff with Julie Christie and her boarding house is really terrific. And, you know, it's one of those movies where, you know, she's got to choose between two people, and it's really hard to see where, you know, what kind of choice she's going to make. I was along for the whole thing. I think John Crowley, who directed the film, you know, I think he's got all the right people. It's a beautiful looking film. The score is nice. Performances, there's not a, you know, single false note in the whole thing. And I really, I think it's just a really beautiful love story and a beautiful story about, you know, that sort of tug of war between starting a new life and reverting back to your old one. You know, this is a great film involving all those themes, and people should definitely go see it.
It's gorgeous. It's just gorgeous. And I echo everything that you've said in this movie. Saoirse Ronan is unbelievable in this movie. It is a tremendous performance. And I agree with you 100%, Colin. Right near the top, if not the top. I'm still a Elizabeth Moss guy in that regard. Like her performance in Queen of Earth, but this is just an extraordinarily beautiful movie. It's lovely, and I know that that sounds like, but it's just a lovely film. I mean, it really is. I think that's the best word to describe it. And you really care about this. And it's you know what's the other thing about it, I think this is one of the reasons why Ronan's performance resonates so much is because the character is on the verge of greatness. Do you know what I mean? It's this young character, and all of this magnificence is before her. And it's so exciting to watch within the film itself, to watch the character have these life experiences right now and what's ahead of her, even no matter what choice she makes. Do you know what I mean? You see a person on the cusp. You see the person on the cusp of a great life and great riches in that life, if that's possible. And that's exactly how I feel about the performance. And that's exactly how I feel about this girl's career. You know, she got an Oscar nomination when she was 12 years old for Atonement, and she was great in that movie. She's been great in everything, and she's versatile as hell. What was the movie where she... Hannah. She's so good in that movie, and she kicked ass, like, physically in that one. And this is... And Hornby is a tremendous screenwriter. John Crowley's a terrific director. You know, the last couple of movies he did some interesting stuff in it, but not great. But this guy's responsible for one of the most vastly, criminally underrated movies of the early 2000s, a film called Intermission. Which,
great movie.
I adore that movie. And one of the reasons I adore it, and Colin and Eric, you guys both know me, you know what my favorite movie is, and it's in that style. It's like 26 different characters, and all their lives intertwine. And this is as separate, as different from that as you can possibly imagine. It's funny, it's wonderful, it's a great love story. It is a beautiful movie. It is a gorgeous movie. It is absolutely lovely. And if you're looking for a movie... You know, I get a lot, you know, I still to this day, I've been doing this for 30 years now, and I still get people who are like, yeah, you like those movies where people get their heads chopped off and people turn into vampires and vomit, you know.
This doesn't happen in this?
No. Oddly, no. And I think it's one of the best films of the year. It is a lovely, beautiful film with a remarkable performance, and I can't tell you how quickly you must see this movie, Eric. You have to. It's a must-see. Okay, hang on, guys, all right?
Mm-hmm.
All right, Eric and Colin are going to join me, and we have to break for the news. And when we come back, we've got one more movie to talk about called Spotlight. And, stick around. We'll take a break here on 720 WGN. Morning. Welcome back, everybody. Movie reviews continuing. We got one more big movie to review between Eric Childress, Colin Suter, and myself, and then we'll let Colin go because he has to teach the children of the world in the morning. And Eric and I have nothing to learn, so we're going to stick around and just learn about the box office. Eric writes about the box office. He does a box office analysis that you can read at movies.com every Eric, when does it go up? Monday morning or Sunday nights?
It usually comes out on Sunday. Sometimes it ends up Monday morning, but it's usually, you know, by late Sunday or Sunday afternoon it's up.
Okay. All right. So Sunday evenings, let's just bank on that. And then it's up at movies.com, and you can read all about it online. And we talk about it on the show as well, which we will do in a couple of minutes here, in just a few minutes. Okay, Eric.
Yes.
Yeah. Let us please, let's talk about Spotlight.
Okay. Oh, well, this is the new film from Thomas McCarthy, who did The Station Agent, The Visitor, Win-Win, really solid resume there as a director. And this is a true story of the Boston Globe journalist who uncovered a really big scandal within the Catholic Church, particularly stemming around the Boston area where they work and live. The spotlight refers to the investigative journalism portion of the Boston Globe, who, as the film opens, is under new editorialship, played by Liv Schreiber, who's trying to figure out what the spotlight people do, and he really wants to tackle a big get them on a big story. So it starts off as hearing about a priest, Father Gagan, at the time, who was accused of molesting dozens of children at the time. And the investigation into this scandal stems off into other branches of the Catholic Church and how this is not just an isolated incident. Michael Keaton plays the head of the journalism team, which is played by Mark Ruffalo, Rachel McAdams. I forget the other guy's name.
Brian Darcy James.
Thank you very much.
Yep.
Who also makes quite an impression in the film. Yeah. And it's populated with other really terrific actors, including Stanley Tucci, who has a really terrific role in it. Billy Crudup plays a really sleazy lawyer. On handling the scandal, and when we talk about movies about journalism, because that's what this movie is. It's a movie about journalism as much as it is about the story that they're handling. Guys like us, it's kind of like crack in a way. These are kind of the things that we aspire to be. We're film critics, but there's something just sort of there's something sexy about, journalism at work. And, that all probably stems from All the President's Men. The first time we saw that, we saw Woodward and Bernstein chasing down the story and taking phone calls and making notes on little pieces of paper, chasing down leads and all these things. And that's basically what you have here, because everyone who's sort of comparing this movie, not sort of, they are comparing this movie to All the President's Men. It's a worthy comparison. It's not just two parallel ways of telling the story. It's absolutely up there on sort of the Mount Rushmore of film stories about journalism. It's watching these people work, watching them sort of objectively break down the story and playing it out like a mystery and covering all kinds of layers, and then seeing the sort of the personal and professional pressure that gets put on them. Little subtle little threats by people who have something to lose if these stories get out. There's not a bad performance in the bunch. It's one of the if not the best ensemble group of the year. It's certainly top two at least. Everyone is so good in the movie. Ruffalo and Keaton are certainly standouts. But like I said, Tucci is really good, and Crudup is good, and even actors who have small roles in the film, like Jamie Sheridan, and some of the people who play some of the victims in the movie. This movie is just fantastic from top to bottom, it's a great story about an important story that a lot of people need to know about, and it's not just an indictment. It's not just a film that's just like, okay, here we're going to take our shots at the Catholic Church and we're just going to nail them. It's not like that, because these people actually question their own faith and they talk to people who are really ingrained in the Catholic Church. Rachel McAdams' grandmother, there's a really key scene with her in the film that is really kind of beautifully handled. I can't heap enough praise upon this movie, and that's why you're hearing people talk about it, and that's why you're going to hear a lot of talk about it during award season.
All right, Colin.
Yeah, I definitely, it's interesting, Eric, that you mentioned that about film critics loving movies about journalism, because I'm predicting that this is going to win a lot of Best Picture awards from a lot of film critic circles, and I'm okay with that. I'm really okay with that, because this is I agree with everything you just said, and it's not a grandstanding movie about journalism either. It's not a movie that is filled with a lot of lofty speeches about the importance of journalism or anything like that. This is, Tom McCarthy directed this film, and the one word you can use to describe almost all of his films, let's not forget The Cobbler, that movie notwithstanding, But the word is understated. This is not a guy who goes for cheap emotions. This is a guy who is in love with subtlety, and is really great at telling stories without being manipulative. And that's definitely the case here. This is a movie that in the hands of other directors would have been the kind of movie you were describing. A movie that is, let's just get the Catholic Church and nail them. No, this is a movie about the characters, and he and his co-screenwriter, his name I can't remember,
Josh Singer.
Yeah, they do a great job of just providing the audience with little nuggets of information about these journalists and their personal lives, without deviating too much from the story. And also, I mean, the way the movie handles 9/11 at one point. It doesn't linger on that too much. There's all this forward momentum getting to the story, but without, sacrificing character development or anything like that. It's a really rich film. It's richly layered, and it's definitely among the top films of the year. It's not a thriller, but it kind of feels like one in a way. I love this guy's movies, again, except for The Cobbler.
Right.
I don't think anybody likes that movie. But this is his masterpiece. I think this is his best film yet. And that's really saying something.
I agree. I also think it's his best film yet. And the thing that I loved most about this movie is that it is, it's not this sort of, nobody has Ruffalo has a couple of moments where it could have turned into a grandiose speech, but it doesn't.
Yeah.
But everything moves forward. Everything is great. And the other thing is that there's different kinds of reporting done in this movie. There's different kinds of investigating done in this movie, and all of it really matters. I think that this movie, the timing of the release of this movie is also pretty important because newspapers are dying. I'm sitting in a building where journalism is dying. There's no question about it. Journalism is dying. Again, we talked about, how everyone dealt with this horrible tragedy that happened on Friday. To go to the social media and to go online is about as non-journalistic as you can possibly get in terms of getting your story, in terms of getting the news. And I'm sitting in a building right now where a lot of people were let go last week. And a lot of people who work, who write, who are journalists, don't work here anymore. And this is a movie that to me is without being heavy-handed, without being overt about it, is a movie that is a plea for journalism. You know what I mean? It's like this stuff needs to exist. And I know it only takes place 14 years ago, but that's a lot of time. It feels a lot longer than 14 years ago because of what has happened in terms of journalism and in terms of technology and how we get our news and how we read about things.
There are scenes where they're actually like trying to figure out like the internet.
Yeah,
in the movie.
Absolutely.
Like, the best way to utilize it.
Absolutely. It's a great film on every level. It's a truly, truly great film. One of the very best movies of the year and absolutely the best ensemble of the year. They don't even need nominees for the SAG ensemble this year. They don't even need any other nominees. That's all there is to it. It's a remarkable piece of work, and Tom McCarthy has cemented himself as one of the best American filmmakers working today. And he was in The Wire.
As a
journalist. And again, David Simon, he may have learned a little something from David Simon because David Simon, obviously, a journalist himself, a very important journalist himself, who took all of that background and infused it into the genius of The Wire, which Tom McCarthy did in this movie. It's a great film. It's a great film. Once again, I don't know what's going on over the past few years with one-word titled movies kicking ass. I don't know why that's been a trend. But like this week, man, Spotlight in Brooklyn, that's all I'm saying. Two of the very, very best films of the year. And I saw them back to back. It was like 4.5 hours of absolute joy. And then I got out of the movie and I got home and then I turned on CNN.
Yeah.
Fun. Yeah. So, but anyway, two remarkable films, Spotlight being one of the best of the year. All three of us say absolutely see it. one of the very best movies of the year. And you're going to hear that a lot, and I don't care. People can say it a million times. It's never going to dull, as far as I'm concerned. Colin, thank you. Eric, really quickly, what do we got next week before we break and come back for box office?
Well, we got the end of the Hunger Games. Mockingjay
right.
Part 2 opens. We got The Night Before with Seth Rogen and Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Mm-hmm.
And we got The Secret in Their Eyes, the remake of the 2009 Oscar winner for Best Foreign Film with Julia Roberts and Nicole Kidman and Chiwetel Ejiofor.
There you go. All right. Colin, thank you, sir, and we will talk to you next week, buddy.
All righty.
All right. Take Bye-bye. Care. And Eric, hang on, okay, sir? All right. Eric's going to hang on. We're going to take a break. We've got some weather. We've got some traffic coming up right here. Morning, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Live in the Allstate Studios on the seventh floor of the Trib Tower, we just reviewed the new movies. The two that are absolute must-sees are Brooklyn and Spotlight, two of the very, very best movies of the year. We are now going to talk about the box office. Eric Childress stays with me to talk about the box office. All right, Eric, let's talk a little bit about this. The number one movie in the country is indeed Spectre with $35.4 million, bringing its total up to $130.7 million. We were talking a little bit about this last week, whether it was going to stay at number one or whether Peanuts would step up or what would happen. How do you feel about it? And by the way, let's just get right to it. Peanuts came in second with $24.2 million, bringing its two-week total to $82 million. How do you feel about the top two here?
I was a little surprised. Spectre had a pretty decent hold. Not that, the four people I talked to during the week, represent America, but, everyone's sort of, the word of mouth on Spectre has been, getting out there that people are not too crazy about it.
Right.
So to have a hold that was basically, only around 50% is not bad at all for the film. It has a better shot at making $200 million now. We'll see how it does in the wake of the Hunger Games. And Peanuts movie, that was a bit of a hangover. That dropped a lot more than I thought it was going to, and that one's probably looking more at, like, Chicken Little numbers than, say, Megamind or Wreck-It Ralph type numbers.
Okay.
So it's probably looking somewhere around $135 million now.
Okay. And let's see. Number three is Love the Coopers. $8.4 million. That's a pretty big drop between your number one, number two, and number three.
Yeah, there was really no hope for the new ones this weekend, although that one surprised me. Of the newcomers, that's the one that made the most money.
Mm-hmm. What, really?
It did for me, yeah.
Yeah? Which one did you think was going to make the most?
I thought 33 would.
Did you?
I didn't think it was going to be a huge number, but I didn't. Love the Coopers made more than I thought it was going to do, and 33 did less.
Okay. So. Number four is The Martian, $6.7 million. Continues to make solid money. And then, as you mentioned, number five is The 33, $5.8 million. Not good.
No, and I write about this in the column this week, that this sort of there's a more interesting story here, I think, with The 33 and a recent spate of movies that have come out. I mean, granted, The 33 doesn't have, fantastic star power. When was the last time Antonio Banderas opened a movie?
Right.
But again, people know the story, and, sometimes the story is enough. But consider that, The 33, Our Brand is Crisis, even The Walk, the thing that these movies have in common is that they're not problems about American characters, really. Mm-hmm. The Walk is, a Frenchman. Did Americans really care about a crazy Frenchman, walking across the towers? Our Brand is Crisis. No one wanted to see a Sandra Bullock movie where she dealt in Central American politics.
Mm-hmm.
And now you got The 33, which is, Chilean miners and a lot of accents and things like that. So I'm curious if, that's going to be a growing trend, that just people are just not, if it's not, American problems, people are just not going to care.
Interesting. That's an interesting way of looking at it. And you break all of this stuff down every week. What about the films like Trumbo and Spotlight and Brooklyn, these little films that opened here this week? Are they doing good numbers in the limited amount of theaters that they're in?
Spotlight certainly is. Spotlight, it's only in 61 theaters, and it almost cracked the top 10 this weekend in just 61 theaters. It's up to $1.8 million, I think, total right now. Brooklyn has also been doing very well. It's only in 23 theaters, and it's got the 784,000 right now.
Okay.
Trumbo is not doing great. Again, it's only in 20 theaters. It's made about $250,000 so far. Not doing particularly great. The movie that does continue to do good business, it really needs to expand soon is Room.
Mm-hmm.
Room is on 133 screens, and it's up to $2.2
million.
Wow. So it's been holding very well, but again, still in a limited number of theaters, and okay. I think A24 has to make that push soon if they really want to, you know, keep it in the Oscar conversation,
okay.
Which it probably still will be.
I think it will be. Okay, so Spectre, again, the big winner this week, but obviously when we talk box office next week, we'll be talking about Hunger Games.
Oh, yeah, that's good. That's going to lead the box office for sure.
Yeah.
It's going to outgrow Spectre in the U.S., although Spectre's up to over $530 million worldwide.
Wow.
Right now.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's, you know, it's making its overseas money big time.
Okay.
And Sony's going to have no problems making its cash back on that, even though it's one of the most expensive movies ever made.
Is that right?
$250 million budget. And you're looking at probably another $100 million in advertising and all that kind of stuff.
Wow.
$350 million price tag on that thing.
That's just really
astounding.
That's
confidence.
It's just astounding. It really
yeah.
is. It's amazing. All right, Eric. Thanks, man. We'll review the movies next week, and everybody can check out your box office report at movies.com. Eric Childress, thank you, buddy. I'll talk to you next week.
Sure thing.
All right, there's Eric Childress. Movie reviews will happen again next Monday. All right, we got to take a break here for the news on 720 WGN.